Hi, this is Starhawk, and I'm hoping that you'll listen to this and really support Radio for Peace International. It's completely listener-supported, and it's our global community forum.
You are listening to Radio for Peace International, and today we're going to be talking to Starhawk. Starhawk is the author or co-author of 9 books, including The Spiral Dance, A Rebirth of Ancient Religion of the Great Goddess, long considered an essential text for the neo-pagan movement, and the now classic ecotopian novel, The Fifth Sacred Thing. Her works have been translated into German, Danish, Dutch, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, French, and Japanese. Her essays are reprinted across the world and have been included in numerous anthologies. Starhawk is a veteran of the progressive movements and deeply committed to bringing the techniques and creative power of spirituality to political activism. She travels internationally teaching magic, the tools of ritual, and the skills of activism. A collection of her recent political writings with new commentary was published in late 2002, Webs of Power, Notes from the Global Uprising. Today, Starhawk will be talking about the Cancun actions and many other political topics. We're honored in the studios today to be recording on location with Starhawk. Starhawk, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I guess the first question is with the upcoming WTO conference in Cancun, Mexico. Can you comment on the WTO and why Cancun is so important?
Yeah, the WTO is the World Trade Organization. And the World Trade Organization, you could say, is the most ambitious institution of corporate globalization. It's the trade agreement that was born out of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in 1995. And in some sense, it's the alternative governance for the world that none of us actually had any say in creating or voted for or ever really signed on to. It was created out of trade agreements that our governments made without really consulting with people and explaining to people the full extent of what they were signing on to. And it has the ability to override laws that we make in our own countries to set the parameters that standards can't go beyond for things like environmental laws and regulations, labor safety, child labor, all of those things. Any law that we make can be overruled by the WTO as restraint of trade. And according to the terms of this treaty we signed on to, we have to go with that. And their decisions are made by tribunals that meet secretly, that don't keep any public records. In fact, they're not allowed to keep public records. They're made by trade bureaucrats, not by judges, not by anyone who's elected or accountable to the people. And their overall agreements are set in ministerials, which take place every 2 years. 4 years ago in Seattle, their ministerial ended in a complete failure, partly because there was so much opposition within the WTO, and partly because there was so much opposition on the streets. And a lot of us, I was there as part of the nonviolent blockade, and we actually shut down the conference center where the WTO was meeting. We filled the streets with people, and I think it helped empower the opposition within the WTO to say, hey, there's masses of people outside who don't like this organization, didn't sign on to this, who want a different kind of world and a different vision of the world. 2 years ago, the WTO met in Qatar, in a country which doesn't allow demonstrations, and which was like truly impossible, even for those of us who are somewhat obsessed and save all our pennies and take all our vacations at protests. You know, it was really, really not possible to go to Qatar. Some of the NGOs did, but ordinary people really couldn't even get there. And nevertheless, they didn't succeed very well in that round. It was basically, for them, it was a holding action. And now what's coming up in September is another ministerial that they're going into with huge dissension within the ranks. Because a lot of the issues that are up now are some of the real basic issues of life, like agriculture, how we're going to grow our food. And what the U.S. is trying to promote, and some of the big countries are trying to promote, is a vision of a world in which nobody actually eats the food that's produced in their own country. Everything's produced in giant industrial agriculture, corporate farms. Everything is shipped around the world, which of course all makes more money for various people, but doesn't necessarily produce the best quality of food or the quality of life for the people who grow the food. And where there's no restraints on chemicals and pesticides and biotech and genetically modified organisms and all of that. What those of us who are going there to protest are saying is, hey, we have a different vision of the world we want to live in. We want to live in a world where food security means that it's actually grown somewhere nearby, where we're not expending more energy to transport the food than we're getting out of the food itself, where we're looking at how do we grow it sustainably and how do we build soil and build health and build community, and where the idea of growing food is that the purpose of growing food is to provide what people need, not to provide profits for large corporations. The other issues that are up for grabs are services. Every endeavor that human beings have done, have supported, have said, okay, this is something we've so big, we have to do it collectively, we have to have some form of government or collective decision making to figure out how are we going to maintain our road system, how are we going to get drinking water to everybody, how are we going to provide education for the next generation. In some enlightened countries, they even extend this to providing health care for people. We don't do much of that in the United States, but maybe some of your listeners live somewhere where they do. All of these things are on the table to be privatized, which means opened up for corporate exploitation, taken out of the hands of government, and put into the hands of corporations. You know, I mean, a lot of us aren't great fans, often, of government. Governments can be inefficient. Nobody's arguing that governments have done a fabulous job all along the way on things. But the thing about something like education is when it's a collective endeavor, when it's something that your government is doing, you have some say in how it's done. You can use your power as a citizen to try to affect how it's done. And there's a certain kind of equality that, at least in theory, is supposed to extend where everybody gets some of it. You know, everybody is supposed to be able to learn how to read, write, do certain things. That's very key to a democratic society. You know, sometimes people say, well, why should I pay for public education? I don't have kids, or my kids, or... But public education isn't about educating your kids. It's about educating the people who are going to be voting for your president 10 years down the line. Yeah, not to mention, you know, driving on the road with you, right? Doing all of those jobs that society needs done, providing the things that need to be provided. So there's major issues, again. And the vision, again, of corporate globalization is that nobody's really responsible for anybody else. We're all in this for ourselves. If you don't measure up, then that's tough luck, but we're not responsible for you. Society has no responsibility, and that's just it. Again, we're saying we stand for different values. We stand for values that say human beings do have responsibility for each other. We are here on the planet to help take care of each other. Everybody has some bad luck in life. You know, sometimes some people more than others, but every single one of us someday is going to break a leg or have a bad love affair and not be able to function for a month, you know, or something, you know, or get old if you're lucky and you live that long, right? And you're going to need help from somebody else. And part of a healthy society is that we do have a way of helping each other through those rough spots so that we can grow and develop and be in a situation where sometime we can help somebody else. And that there is something more to life than profit making. I think that's something that really actually cuts across some of the standard political divisions, some of the ways people have often aligned themselves. I'm a liberal, I'm conservative, I'm this or that. If you look, every religion, every political philosophy, at some level, well, not every political philosophy, but you know, but every culture that's lasted for any length of time has always said the purpose of life is not just providing for the greed of a few or the military power of the rulers. The purpose of life has something to do with our connection with deeper values, with the sacred, with each other, with your kids, with the community, with your own creativity. And we want a world where that's valued.
If the WTO is able to do what it intends to or is attempting to do in Cancun, there's some big changes that might happen.
Yeah, if the WTO succeeds in what's on the table in Cancun, for example, we would see massive numbers of small farmers driven out of agriculture in the third world and also in the U.S. Already in the last decades of globalization, what we've seen happen in the U.S. is we've lost a third of our family farms. And that's up here. In Mexico, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, has already been devastating to the small farmers of that country. It allows us to take corn, which is subsidized in the U.S. to keep the prices artificially low, and dump it on the Mexican market. And that basically drives their farmers who are providing for local subsistence farming and for local regional farming, drives them out of business. And so we've seen massive numbers of people from the countryside displaced, having to go to the cities to find work where there's no services for them. You'll find Mexico City is surrounded by rings and rings and rings of squats, you know, where people just go, camp, build, and there's no sewage, there's no water, there's no nothing. And they go north and try to come into the United States where there's work. And some of them make it, and some of them don't. And many of them end up on the border in maquiladoras, which are the factories there, where people work for very low wages in, again, horrific substandard living conditions to produce cheap goods that enrich a few. The ocean near Tijuana and on that side of the border is the most polluted anywhere in Mexico or the U.S. because of all the effluent from these factories, which can hop over the border and be exempt from U.S. environmental standards, where they can be paying their laborers, you know, $4 or $5 a day instead of $4 or $5 an hour, where they don't have to provide job security or benefits or unemployment or any of those things.
Been involved in activism training or action training. What are you training people to do in Cancun, or what are you planning to do in Cancun?
We're planning to do a couple of different things in Cancun. We've been doing nonviolent direct action trainings for people who will be marching, be taking the streets, possibly be blocking delegates. Or one of the plans, the idea was to take over the streets of Cancun City and offer services, since the WTO is debating taking them away, because Cancun City itself is the city where all the workers live who service the big hotels. And the big hotels are often a separate zone on the beach. They have the breezes and the beautiful ocean view, but nobody actually lives where the big hotels are. It's really a model of globalization. You know, you have the rich on one side and the poor on the other. And in Cancun City itself, 2/3 of the houses aren't even hooked up to the sewage system. So people don't want to be we don't want to be directing protest at Cancun City. But we are suspecting it may be very difficult after the meeting starts to get into the hotel zone, because it's just one road in and out. So it's easy to block. We're also bringing a group down there who wants to set up the campgrounds for all the protesters and to help set them up as eco-villages, as models of things like composting and sustainability. And so we're going down early to negotiate with the city and to see what we can do along those lines.
How do you feel the groups of direct action folks are going to be received by the local folks that live in Cancun? How are you working with the local people there?
We have groups who are from Cancun City who've begun doing outreach down there, who've been showing videos about the WTO in Spanish, who've been flyering, talking to people. And we're hoping that many people from Cancun City will come out and join us, or will at least understand why we're there and what we're doing. Cancun City is an odd city because it's only a few decades old. It was set up by the Mexican government as a tourist place and tourist city, and nothing much really existed there before. So it's not like a real city in a sense that has a tradition of any kind of social organizing. But there are many people there who are conscious and who are eager to work on this issue and have been working on it.
What effect has the demonstrations, especially the Seattle demonstrations, had on the WTO? Have they changed their policy or tactics or timelines because of any of these demonstrations?
I think the demonstrations around the WTO have had a huge effect. Before the demonstrations in Seattle, there was a general sense that corporate globalization was the wave of the future. It was inevitable, and fighting it was like trying to fight the introduction of the telephone or something. It's just completely backwards, and you couldn't do it. You might as well grit your teeth and go along with it. After Seattle, it began to look less inevitable. In fact, it began to look very shaky, and with each failed ministerial, it's become shakier and shakier. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are kind of the other two pillars of globalization, with the policies that they've imposed on third world countries. And again, the criticism of those policies, it's not like they have done major shifts at this point, but they have at least rethought some things. And at least at this point, they've rethought how they do their PR about it, probably more than real change. The real change in those institutions is probably going to be very, very long in coming, because they're supported by some very strong vested interests that want to keep them going in the direction they're going. But the demonstrations, I think, have awoken people's consciousness worldwide. And a lot of people today know and understand things about the WTO or about the World Bank or about this whole process. At least know that it's an issue and it's on the table, and some people object to it. They may not know necessarily exactly why. I mean, during the WTO demonstrations, Tom Hayden, who was our assemblyman from Santa Monica, old radical, I remember he said something like, you know, a week ago, nobody knew what the WTO is, and now they still don't know what it is, but they know it's bad.
You've recently released a book called The Webs of Power. I believe that would be a good source for someone who's looking for education. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, my book, Webs of Power, talks a lot about the global justice movement, particularly from the blockades in Seattle through September 11th. Some of it are sort of like dispatches that I wrote at the time and sent out to people on email. It started with an essay I wrote after Seattle called How We Really Shut Down the WTO. That I wrote because I was mad at the media coverage, which seems so completely distorted. And it talks about our model of organizing and affinity groups and with sort of a bottom-up style of organizing rather than a top-down style. Part of the book is some deeper discussions of questions about diversity or violence and nonviolence and some of the debates that go on in the movement. It's called Webs of Power, Notes from the Global Uprising. People can go to my website, which is starhawk.org, and find information on how you can get that or the other books I've written. I've written something like 9 now. And some of them are on the political, and some of them are more on earth-based spirituality. And you can also get it at bookstores or get your bookstore to order it. It's New Society Publishers.
And could you give your website again?
My website is www.starhawk.org. That's S-T-A-R-H-A-W-K.
Are you aware of the carbon deposit trading program? And do you have any comments about that?
This sort of carbon trading program, I think it's another example of the level of insanity we've sunk to. If we know something is bad and we should stop doing it, then I can avoid stopping doing it by getting you to stop doing it instead. For me, it's really quite senseless, because the reality is that we all need to make a shift right now. Global warming is a very serious issue. Some of your listeners may be out on some of the islands in the Pacific that really stand to disappear if the sea level rises considerably. The effects and the impact on the life of the planet are potentially enormous and very, very far-reaching. And I think it's really a measure of our failure as a global civilization that we can't seem to grasp and look and deal with this when in fact we actually have the technologies that would let us shift and still live very comfortably on renewable energy sources, on wind and sun, and even now hydrogen fuel cells and many other possibilities. It's not like we can't do it. What we're up against is that there are very strong vested interests that are so deeply tied into the oil industry that don't want to lose their power and they don't want to lose their source of wealth. And unfortunately, they are now running the U.S. They pushed us into the war in Iraq so that we could gain control of those oil resources. And I think it's something we as a global people need to be standing up against, as we have done this last year. In February, we saw probably the largest global demonstration ever in the history of the world against the war in Iraq. And I think a lot of people may be feeling discouraged because the war still went on and still is going on. But I don't think we should be discouraged. I think we need to understand that that was the beginning and we need to grow even stronger than we are, because we really do need to make a huge transition right now. And if we can make that transition, the earth is still a resilient and live and wonderful place with great powers of health and creativity. Once you make that transition, once you start working with nature, if you ever shift and start gardening organically, or you start using solar or renewable or wind power, or thing, what you find is that it creates a positive cycle where things start to grow and get healthier, and that feeds other things and they grow and they get healthier. Stuff comes back. Life feeds more life, and you begin to get a kind of upward spiral of life and vibrancy and diversity. And we can still have that on the planet, but possibly not for much longer.
Starhawk, you're involved in so many different types of actions and issues. For many people that are just waking up and they're looking at the world, the shape it's in, and the politics that got us here, they see that, and then oftentimes they feel so overwhelmed that they don't do anything. What do you say to those people?
I think it's quite easy to look at what we have to deal with and feel overwhelmed. But what I always say is just start doing something. Pick the thing maybe that's closest to hand or right in your face. And when you begin to do something, you'll start to feel empowered. And as you begin to feel empowered around one thing, you'll begin to feel more empowered around other things. And start doing something you care about, something you're passionate about, something you love. Don't do what you feel guilty or you feel, you know, oh, I should be doing this. Or I can't. Work for what you love, and that will energize you so much that you'll have 1,000 times more energy to help create the changes that you want to see in the world.
The words peace and security seem to be getting tied together quite often these days. It's made me feel less comfortable with the word security. Do you have any comments on that?
It's always interesting how you can take a perfectly good word like peace, you know, and twist its meaning. Peace and security, I think we have to ask ourselves, what is real security? Does real security come from amassing huge numbers of weapons and huge police forces? Or does it come from having a society that's healthy, where people know each other, where people look out for each other, where people take care of each other? Does it really come from saying, we're the big bullies and we have so much power we can make any country in the world do what we want? Or does it come from saying, we're going to work cooperatively and build systems of global cooperation between countries and between nations? I think if we want peace, peace is not just a negative state. Peace needs to be an active state, a state of really creating a vision of a world where we take care of each other, where human beings have some claims on each other. I had a friend visiting from New Zealand, and she was kind of wandering around saying, like, I don't understand how you people can live in this country. You have no health insurance. What if you get sick? Oh, I don't understand how you're so brave. Like, you know. And I said, yeah, does security mean we have the largest military in the known universe? But if I fall and break my leg, I'm going to lose everything because I have no health insurance and there's no medicine that the country provides. If I get old, if I can't function, is that going to be the end of my life? No, that's not security. I was in the occupied territories in Palestine a lot last year doing a nonviolent peace witness with a group called the International Solidarity Movement. And one of the things that really struck me was, in spite of the tremendous violence that's going on there against the Palestinian people every day, people getting shot, never knowing when you're going to be able to go to work, when you're going to be able to go to school because of the curfews and the closures, a huge level of insecurity in life. But there's a level in which there's a kind of social security that's still there in their society, where people do take care of each other. Families take care of each other. You don't see homeless people, in spite of the terrible poverty that's there and the terrible unemployment and the toll that the whole situation has taken on the economy. Nobody's sleeping in the streets. Somebody always takes somebody in. If you're traveling there, people just go out of their way to help you get where you're going, to feed you. I've turned up like in the middle of nowhere in some little village, you know, getting a ride from a truck on the way from Nablus to Jenin or someplace, and a guy run out of his gas station to say, "Sid, eat. Oh, here, have water, have cola, have lunch." You know, it creates a different kind of security. And this kind of security, I think in the United States at least, we don't even have a conception of. But the kind of security where you know that there's a net that is the community that will catch you if you stumble and fall. And it creates a kind of basic feeling of personal security that I think goes way beyond anything we can amass with more money spent on police and prisons and guns and tanks and bombs and all those other things, which to my mind don't really make us all that much more secure.
And where do you find all the energy to do all that you're doing?
I do have a lot of energy, yeah. But I renew it by spending time in nature, taking walks in the woods, spending time with my partner and with my friends. And even though I do a lot of work on a lot of different issues, one of the things that feeds me is just the community of people that I'm connected to. In June, I was working with a group of people. We were organizing a protest around a big agriculture conference in Sacramento that was promoting biotech to all the agricultural ministers of the world. And it was an enormous amount of work. And there weren't all that many people organizing it for the work that had to be done. And we were really stretched. But we kept looking around at each other going, you know, the thing is, we're having such a good time with each other, right? We're enjoying this so much that it makes up for all of the work. I think the more that we can make our organizing and our groups places where we cheer each other on and support each other on every single level, then the more energy we have to do the work.
Starhawk, thank you for giving us your time for an interview.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You have been listening to an interview with Starhawk by Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson for Radio for Peace International. Radio for Peace International is facing a crisis situation, a lockout by the University of Peace, or so-called, against the Radio for Peace in El Rodeo, Costa Rica. You can find out more about this Pacifica-type lockout by logging on to our website, www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org. Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson are both graduates of the Institute for Progressive Communications, a radio communication course taught on the grounds of Radio for Peace International, 1 hour west of San Jose, the capital of Costa Rica. This interview and many other interviews and speeches were taken from Soulfest 2003. Radio for Peace International would like to thank the organizers of Soulfest for all their help in making these interviews possible.